D-Maze, Vingan, and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, and Adam Vingan here with you, joined on our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, by Mitch Light of The Athletic, to discuss college football, as we do every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Mitch, we were talking to Clark Lee earlier in the week. Vanderbilt, a tough loss to Texas at home over the weekend. They're at Auburn, who's under 500, but Auburn is a 7-point favorite at home against Vanderbilt. Are you surprised by that?
No, not really. I think Willie asked me. Sorry, I do a weekly show with Louie Bellina in College Station, so I got my host mixed up there. I'll just call him Louie from now on. Willie asked that question last week, and I think really my guess was like 3.5 or 4 without seeing, you know, the results of last weekend. Auburn's an interesting team. They are, you know, if you like stats, they're better than their record would indicate. I'm looking right now, they're averaging 6.9 yards per play, which is 16th nationally, but they're near the bottom in scoring because they turn the ball over so much. So they have, you know, Peyton Thorne, the quarterback's much maligned. Everything about Auburn this year has been much maligned, but, you know, they've had some games where they just had no business losing and they lost, and they went up to Kentucky and played very well. This is still a very talented team. They've got really good young wide receivers. So I am not surprised that Vanderbilt's an underdog at Auburn.
Have you ever noticed that no one's ever just maligned? They're much maligned.
That's a good point.
It's just, we talked about this a few weeks ago. Nobody's ever gruntled. You're always disgruntled, but you're never just gruntled. I don't even know if gruntled is a word, but everyone's disgruntled.
That's a good point.
Not gruntled, but everybody's much maligned. You're never just maligned. You have to be much maligned. But let's keep it in the SEC, Mitch. Texas squeaks out a win against Vanderbilt. Texas A&M, by ranking, upsets LSU, though I believe Texas A&M was favored in that game.
Yeah.
Alabama thrashes Missouri to get back on the winning track. Ole Miss wins. Tennessee was off last week. So as we what is the state of the SEC in your mind as we enter week 10, and how do you think how do things shake out from here, do you think?
Well, based on the opening clip, you should be pleased because there's
ooh, maximum chaos.
Longtime reporter Adam Vingan, I like maximum chaos.
Yes, I do.
So, and to defend you, we can have chaos without maximum chaos.
That is
maximum
true.
Although it is a little redundant because the definition of chaos, whatever. I don't need to go down that.
That's
road.
Like when people say something is very unique.
Oh well, I was going to say that before. I hate that. And
that's the worst.
When I was your editor for that brief time, if you ever said that, which I knew you wouldn't, I would take out the word very because you cannot be very unique.
Exactly. Please go ahead. I'm sorry.
People are loving us nerd talk about this. So
yes.
So I would say I wouldn't say there's maximum chaos. I say there's chaos in the SEC just because we're this far in the season and you've got five teams with one loss or less. None of them is Alabama. None of them is Ole Miss, a preseason top 10-ish team. Texas A&M, who not left for dead, but they did not. Not only did they lose at home to Notre Dame, they didn't look good doing so offensively, and that was just a stunning second half. I think we still all think Georgia's probably the best team in the league, asserted their dominance against Texas. I still love Texas' overall talent. I think they showed some weaknesses the past 2 weeks on an offensive line that, if you follow recruiting rankings or NFL draft forecast, should be one of the best in the country. So there are issues there. You know, LSU has its own problems on both sides of the ball. So I think we're in store for a really fun November, and there are so many possibilities for the two teams that are going to play for the SEC title.
We're talking to Mitch Light, talking college football. Now, Mitch, what is the biggest story in college football this year? Is it obviously Colorado was picked to finish last or dead almost last in the Big 12, but we see how they've been able to overcome that and they only have two losses, and I think they are second in the Big 12 as they sit right now. Or is it Indiana? Indiana was 3-9 last year. They get a new coach, and all of a sudden you make this turnaround where they're undefeated, and I think they're ranked 13th as we speak now.
Yeah, To me, it's Indiana. Colorado is, as you mentioned, they're 4-1. They are tied for second, tied for third. I think they're definitely a good story. They're a legit good team. I thought, we'll see. If they end up playing for Big 12 title, then I think we can elevate them up that good story or biggest story. I think it's Indiana. Just coming from a non-traditional program, we've seen other programs make leaps, but the fact that it's Indiana and Kurt Cignetti, who I think, you know, those of us that follow college football, I knew who Kurt Cignetti was, did a great job at James Madison and worked his way up, but was a relative no-name coach, comes in, and I know the schedule hasn't been difficult, but just they have been dominating on both sides of the ball. They found a way to win comfortably last week without Curtis Rourke, their quarterback, former Tennessee quarterback, Taven Jackson, filling in. So I am really excited to watch that the game when they play Ohio State. Yeah, there's a lot of other, you know, good stories. I think Vanderbilt's been a good story nationally. I think Penn State's very intriguing and interesting. They have won every game so far. I was really interested last week to see what would happen in the second half when Drew Aller got hurt. Bo Prubella came in and was very, very good. I think this is the first time I'm picking Penn State to beat Ohio State in many years. So I think if Penn State wins this game this week, Derek, both of those programs, for different reasons, can kind of elevate themselves up in the interesting stories for this season.
Now, UT is coming off a bye week, but they had a huge win versus Alabama. Contrast that to Kentucky. They're reeling, you know, three straight losses. It started with Vanderbilt, then Florida, and obviously they lost to Auburn last week. Is that win, or was that win versus Alabama, sort of a springboard, not for the defense necessarily, but for the offense, what they were able to do, especially in the second half? The first half was, I thought, pretty good. There were shots to be taken. There were plays to be made. Either the quarterback overthrew it or the receivers dropped passes. It seemed like they finally got it all together in the second half, and you saw an explosion from that UT offense.
I thought the first half was sort of an example of quieting the "have people figured Josh Heupel's offense out" narrative, because there were guys open, as you mentioned. And I can't tell you whether two or three times where Nico just overthrew a receiver. There was plays to be, I think you just said, there were plays to be had they didn't make. In the second half, kind of where the Nico can't get it done quieted that narrative. Now, it was only for a half, that's three games in a row where they did not score in the first half, and that's not championship quality football. You can't sustain that over the course of the year. But I think they did answer a lot of questions in the second half. What a way to go into a bye week by, you know, controlling the ball in the second half, playing great football to beat, you know, your hated rival. So, yeah, in Kentucky, on the other hand, not much is going well up there. They're really struggling on offense. I don't think Brock Vandergrift's been healthy all year. You know, Gavin Wimsett, the transfer, the in-state kid who went to Rutgers, comes back. He's not really the answer. Just been a really rough stretch for Mark Stoops. And, you know, this is a series that Tennessee has dominated not for the most part. They've dominated. Kentucky's made them sweat a couple times, you know, recently and been competitive. But if you're looking at two programs right now going in opposite directions, you're a perfect example this week.
Okay, Mitch, let's look at a couple of upset possibilities here. South Carolina, at just a 2.5-point underdog at home, I think they're kind of sneaky good, and they've got the lone undefeated team in the league coming into town. I think that's going to be a pretty intriguing matchup.
Yeah, well, speaking of Louis, I was on the air earlier this week with Louis Blaine at College Station. He was asking me, like, what should we know about South Carolina down here? I was like, they're – defensive line's among the best in the league. And, you know, this year seemingly more than many, Willie, there's a lot of teams that can say, oh, we could be X and O or so-and-so and one if we made three more plays. Well, South Carolina's in that group. You know, they got manhandled. They got beat badly at home, the Ole Miss. But I think in the coulda, woulda, shoulda, they should have beaten LSU at home, had a couple tough whistles, could have beaten Alabama on the road. They have wins in the SEC on the road of 31-6 and 35-9. Dylan Stewart, their true freshman defensive end, a five-star, is very, very good. They are, you know, Lenora Sellers is fun to watch at quarterback. He's a little mistake-prone, but Rock Sanders, a running back to transfer from Arkansas, is, you know, when healthy, among the best in the league. So this is a very tough spot for Texas A&M, coming off the big win, the emotional win. I don't know what LSU – I don't know enough about football to sit here and tell you that LSU just had no clue what to do with Marcel Reed, but to me, they look like they had no clue, like they'd never heard of him, even though he'd started games before. I expect South Carolina will have a better plan for him, assuming he's the quarterback, and make him throw the ball. So I was not surprised that this was such a slight spread. I think South Carolina has a very good chance to win this game.
And with that in mind, like I asked you last week, I think if people are circling South Carolina and saying, well, South Carolina at home, Vanderbilt should take care of it. South Carolina, I think, likely will be favored here against Vanderbilt. Fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, they're three road games, 31-6 at Kentucky, 27-25 loss at Alabama, 35-9 win at Oklahoma. Now, if Vanderbilt goes down and plays really well at Auburn and South Carolina has an offensive
no-show,
lays an egg there, then things can change there. But, you know, the thing that South Carolina has struggled with is turnovers, and that's what Vanderbilt has done well before the Texas game, winning that turnover battle. So as far as matchup goes and strengths and weaknesses, all that could be something that, you know, if teams keep playing like they've been playing, that could go in Vanderbilt's favor. But yeah, I mean, Vanderbilt isn't good enough to just sit there and say, oh, you know, they have not gotten the respect of the boys in Vegas this year with the spreads, and that's why they have a very good record against the spread. But clearly this team is not talented enough to sit here and say, oh yeah, they're definitely going to be favored going to Auburn, definitely going to be favored against South Carolina.
They've got to play tight. Arkansas, an improved team, playing at home against Ole Miss, who has looked shaky at times. I'm really intrigued about this game with Arkansas playing at home and with, you know, already a win over Tennessee under their belt. What do you think of that matchup?
Yeah, underrated rivalry, just the Houston Nut Bowl. Always fun when these teams, they've had some chaotic games. You know, this is – we talked a lot about Bobby Petrino in the offseason coming in, and I guess he's behaved. There doesn't seem to be any Bobby Petrino stories floating around. I was really impressed Arkansas going down – because Mississippi State had been playing better with Van Buren, the freshman quarterback. They'd been, you know, putting up some points. But just to go down to Mississippi State, and you win 58-25 on the road against any team in this league, you're doing some things really well. They had 673 yards of offense, averaged 10.2 yards per play. That's obviously, you know, going to win you a lot of games doing that. So I like Arkansas in this game. Ole Miss has not been great on the offensive line. They don't seem to be running the ball as well this year. And I'm really interested to see what the chemistry of that team is. When they're not out of the college football playoff, but they already have two losses. They're kind of teetering right now. When you build what you think is a championship roster and it's not going how it's going, when you enter the month of November, I always think it's very interesting to see, you know, how these coaches keep these teams together. So I think it's kind of a big, kind of a culture game for Ole Miss. Obviously a tough place to play.
Mitch Light, college football editor at The Athletic, joining us to discuss the landscape of college football as he does every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Mitch, I'll let the maximum chaos bit slide. That is true. They are redundant, but it makes for good radio, so I'm just going to stick with it.
Well, your much maligned radio guest is saying goodbye for the week.
All right. Say goodbye, Louie.
Take care, guys.
Thanks, Mitch.
All right.
You look like a Louie, Willie. If your name was Louie, it would fit.
Man, Louie?
Unfortunately, there
I'm
are
thinking
no.
Thinking of Animal House. Louie Delta Donick. House. Louie, Louie. We there, might need to play that song coming back.
There Louie are no. Donick. There are
the
no.
The Kingsman.
Louie. Louis D. Louis D. So we'll stick with Willie. 615-737-1025. We'll get back into the Titans next. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Finn, 1025, 1063, The Game. D. Mace. Bingen and Donick, 102.5, 106.3, The Game. Louie Donick, Derek
yeah, Louie
Mason.
Donick, yeah.
So if you
Adam
get called
Bingen,
the wrong name, make it to be a fun name that there's a fun song. Unlike me, when I called you the wrong name, there's just no song called Jared.
Not that I'm aware of.
Not a fun
me
song.
Either, no.
Maybe there is one, but.
Not a fun song.
Louie's a fun name, though.
Yeah, I will tell you a funny story back in the day.
When I was we could do the other. Let's find there's a song called Louie. I'll find the name of it too. That's another fun song.
Back when I was living in Washington before I moved to Nashville, and I would do hits on the sports talk station in DC, 106.7 The Fan. And I would appear on the station, and one of the hosts thought that my last name, which is pronounced Vingen, was a little bit fancier, and he pronounced it Vignon, like rhymes like rhymes with mignon. And I had to tell him his name was Danny. I said, Danny, I appreciate you sprucing up my last name and saying it's Vignon, but it's actually Vingen. And from that point forward, he just called me Steak whenever I was on the air.
Steak?
Steak.
Where did he get Steak?
Well, filet mignon. Oh, yeah, Vignon. Is a steak. Yeah, okay, a filet mignon is a steak.
So he was calling you Mignon?
He was calling me Vignon.
Oh, Vignon.
Rhymes with Mignon. Okay. I was like, unfortunately, it's Vingen.
Oh, wow.
But anyway.
You sure you ain't going to change the enunciation of your last name like some people do? You know, some people change. You've been calling them one thing forever. And they've allowed you, and then all of a sudden they, no, my name is this.
I've noticed this a lot in hockey, and I'm sure Willie has as well, being a broadcaster. Willie and people of Willie's ilk are very particular about how certain names are pronounced. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when you, and this is just my experience as a reporter, you would go to a player. Here's another example from the past. When I was covering the Capitals, they had a prospect by the name of Cameron Schilling. And when Schilling first arrived in the NHL, we would say, do you prefer Cameron or Cam? Mm-hmm. And he would say, Cameron's fine. You can call me Cameron. And then shortly thereafter, he was like, it's actually Cam. I prefer Cam. I was like, well, pick one.
Yeah.
Is it Cameron or Cam? I'm sure you've dealt with – Tons of times. There was a player – You know, speaking of the Oilers, there was a player for there was a veteran defenseman back in the day. His name was Andre Sequeira, and I believe Sequeira did play for the Oilers at one point. He played for a lot of teams, but he was in the league for like 10 plus years, and everybody knew him as Andre Sequeira. And then one day he was just like, "Actually, it's Sequeira."
He was from the, I guess it's now called Czechia.
Yes, he was from the Czech Republic.
But the Czech names are the toughest to pronounce, and almost always change the most, and so if you Americanize them, it's something completely different than how it's actually pronounced. The most famous predator in predator history who that is the case is Martin Erat, who still lives in Nashville now. But Marty Erat was his Americanized name, and from day one, that's kind of what he preferred. And then Pete and Terry tell this hilarious story. He made the Olympic team, Erat, in 2006 for the Czech Republic. And so there was Czech media coming to watch the Predators play. And the Czech representative, who was the media person there, went to Pete and Terry and said, you guys are saying his name wrong. It's Erat. Erat. So for one game, Pete and Terry tried to do it.
Erat.
Erat. But they've been doing Martin Erat for 8 years or something like that.
And he had no problem with it.
And so after one game, they're like, you know what? And Marty himself was like, you guys, just go back to saying Erat. It's much easier.
Do y'all remember when Tyrod Taylor went
That's the dilemma a lot of times with the foreign players.
It was Tyrod, right? It went from Tyrod Taylor to Tyrod Taylor, correct?
I didn't know that.
Like
I did not
Terrell
know that.
That was like in 2018 or something like that.
To Terrell
Owens. Right. Yeah, that was another big one.
Greg on our text line brings up another former Nashville Predators player, Pontus Åberg to Pontus Åberg.
No,
or was it the other way around?
No, it's actually Åberg.
Okay.
If you say it in Swedish, even though it's the letters are A B E R G, so when you see it, it's Åberg or Åberg, and so if you don't really say A in Sweden, so the Americanized is Åberg, and he was actually playing pretty well as Åberg. But then he told everybody, you know, if you're actually doing it,
he went to
Swedish,
Auburn.
He went right around the corner to Åberg or Åberg, but in Swedish that has a special symbol over the A, and so it's pronounced Åberg.
His career took a tumble when he decided to.
Yes, he's never been the same.
Also a former member of the Edmonton Oilers, so everything ties back into the game tomorrow. But with the
you can't win because you always have that person that thinks you're doing it wrong. And we'll let you know on Twitter, by the way, like, hey, let me tell you something. Like we don't know that this is the deal sometimes. Like, they just assume that we're stupid and we haven't looked at this. There's usually a reason why. A recent one is this is no excuse. This guy's from Canada. It shouldn't happen. Brad Marchand. For years and years, Marchand. But it seemed to yo-yo back and forth, and their broadcasters are adamant. It's always been Marchand. But in the national broadcast, it commonly gets pronounced wrong. So why is it that always happens to hockey?
So now I'm going to read this text, and hopefully I don't mispronounce the name, but Dylan on our text line mentions Santiago Vescovi from Tennessee.
Yes.
Was a mispronunciation that went on for a long time. What's the proper pronunciation?
I don't know. I thought it was.
I think a lot of people were saying it wrong for a long time, and he's one of those guys that had the extra COVID years. He was there forever. But I think it's Vescovi is the right way to say it. I think it was Vescovi for a long, long time, incorrectly.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Vescovi.
And Vescovi, and but Amy, it's actually Vescovi is the accent on the first syllable.
Amy from Arkansas mentions Marek Zidlitsky.
That's another Zidlicky. One that's changed a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Because technically in the Czech, it's Zidlitsky, if you're doing it right. Zidlitsky.
Pick one name, people, and stick with it. That's
so he was
I'm
like
saying.
Three different ones. Zidlicky, Zidlitsky, Zidlitsky. Three right, different ways
so
to do it. The same,
you're,
same
Louis,
guy.
You're Louis Donick and you're Derek Mason from now on.
Derek Mason.
And you are Filet Vignon.
In French, yes.
And I am Filet Vignon.
I'm going to change my name, Mason.
Yes. Derek Mason.
Mason.
So Mike Sando in The Athletic had a story about the Anthony Richardson situation. And one former executive from one of the Colts' division rivals, so maybe it's the Titans, called it, quote, a fascinating management dilemma. And this gets into something that we've talked a lot about on the show. Sando writes, quote, those unfamiliar with NFL team and locker room dynamics, like me, for example, will point to comparisons such as the 10-start comps for Richardson and the Bills' Josh Allen, suggesting Indianapolis is sacrificing the future for short-term gains. They don't see any upside in riding Flacco to what might wind up being, at best, a short-lived playoff run. I am in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Those on the inside, like Derek was, see things differently. To them, the Colts decided the price for leaving Richardson in the lineup under these circumstances was higher than the price for replacing him. They chose to save the locker room now in hopes of saving Richardson later because they understand the tricky dynamics at work. And then one executive says, quote, if you enable him now, you lose everything because you sent the wrong message to your team and you sent the wrong message to him that his behavior is acceptable. He will never recover from it.
Yeah, but this is not when you say when he writes behavior, that means to me something. He's doing something, you know, outside of football when you say his behavior. So I think that choice of word is probably wrong to use.
But they meant him coming out of the – out of the game.
But
The
question is that just an example of other things like that where he doesn't get it or it doesn't have the right makeup? Because none of us are watching that team every week. None of us are obviously in that locker room to see how far that goes.
Exactly. And listen – because I heard someone, you know, sort of, you know, question his character because of what he did. I don't know how you can question someone's character because they chose to say, listen, if you actually saw the play, I thought he hurt his knee, honestly, when he got tackled. He threw off a 300-plus pounder. Then he had to scramble and do all this. Then somebody undercutting and hit him at the knees, and his knees turned kind of awkwardly. I thought he hurt his knee. Then he goes down, and he gets up on the knee and sits there for a minute. Then he taps his head. He got tired, man. That has nothing to do. You don't know how much stuff he's went through as a quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts that he's probably – put up with physically. Like, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm not complaining. I'm going out here playing, and I'm getting beat up. I'm getting thrown down because of my stature. You know, they want me to run more as I develop as a quarterback. I'm doing all these things, and I'm not complaining. But I steady get beat up. And then the one time I tapped my helmet, which he shouldn't have done it. I get it. They should have found a way to help the young man. Like, listen, go down. You tap, go down so we can call a timeout or come out and see if something's wrong with you. That's how you help your quarterback. I blame the coaching staff. They didn't help him in that situation. After he ran around, got undercutted, his knee twisted a little bit, and now everybody's questioning his character? What world do we live in when you question a man's character because
he just
got beat up?
It's got to be more than that, though, doesn't it?
That's what I'm saying.
It's got to be more than
that. It has to be more than just that one play. But when people start questioning his character, Like, that has nothing to do with his character. So what are you, are you questioning every player that taps out? Because my thing is, you shouldn't tap out. If it was based on me, you would start it. You don't tap out. You don't. You stay in there, you catch your breath, and you keep going. But that's not how the NFL works nowadays. They're rotating guys in and out, in and out. The only guy that doesn't rotate in and out is the quarterback. But the one time the young quarterback taps his helmet, and I'm not saying he shouldn't have, he should have done that. But what I'm saying is the first time the young man, after he's been getting beat up, taps his helmet, now you're questioning his character? Give me a break.
The one thing that stands out to me, and this is how—
unless there's other stuff going on like Willie said.
The one thing I want to talk about in relation to the Titans is this idea that the Colts, according to this story from Mike Sando, that the Colts chose to save the locker room now in hopes of saving Richardson later because they understand the tricky dynamics at work. We've had this conversation all season long with Will Levis. Will Levis is going to give it a go at practice today. We'll see if he starts on Sunday against the Patriots. But, Derek, you've touched on this all season long about the risk of losing the locker room if you stick with Will Levis too long when he's been struggling. Now, as you also said earlier, the Titans gave themselves an out because Levis has been injured. But I'm curious about what's going on inside the Titans offices and the Titans locker room, because it feels like in some ways a very similar situation with the Titans and Will Levis and the Colts and Anthony Richardson.
Yeah, it's similar from the standpoint neither quarterback is playing particularly well at all. I think Indianapolis is a little they're more suited as a team, meaning, you know, I don't think they're looking for their left or right tackle. I don't think they're looking for a playmaker in a wide receiver room. I think they believe they have at least two in a wide receiver room, maybe even three. So they're not looking at – they're not trying to find leaders and they're not trying to find playmakers. The Titans are, on the other hand, that's what they're trying to do right now. They're trying to establish their leaders and they're trying to find – in establishing their leaders, they're trying to find playmakers, guys that can help them not just today but tomorrow and moving forward. So these are two different situations. You have one quarterback that is a little bit older than the other quarterback. One quarterback, it seemed like you had a plan for him. Now there's been a derailment of the plan. I don't know how you put him back on that plan or what you're going to do to put him back on that plan. And the other, I don't think they truly had a plan for him because they didn't prepare for him to play last year. So those two are different from that standpoint. And then this Titan team, they are at this sort of crossroads. I don't think Indianapolis is at a crossroad right now. I think Indianapolis is doing something because they understand that it's not just Houston is not running away with the division. They're still Indianapolis is the only team that can catch Houston, and Indianapolis knows it. So they're going to put in a more seasoned veteran guy and let him ride and see how far they can go with him. And I'm sure whatever their plan is for Richardson, it's going to be implemented. If they don't have a plan for him, then that's just malpractice on their point. The Titans know they're not catching Houston. And in the midst of all of that, they don't want to lose the locker room. You know, do they have something to play for in the sense of playoffs? Probably not. But they do have something to play for in regards to keeping that locker room together, because these are some of the guys that are going to be carryovers for the next year as well. And you don't want to lose those guys knowing that they're going to be back next year. So you got to make a change in order to keep that locker room together.
There are some things distinctly different, I think, about the two situations, but there are some parallels. Yeah. I think Joe Flacco is more productive right now, certainly has a better track record than Mason Rudolph. So I think there is a difference of Flacco and Rudolph. But I think one of the – and the other thing is Richardson is a lot younger than Will Levis. I think they can take a little longer view. There's so much invested in Richardson. I can't imagine they're going to cast him off and never give him another chance. But it does bring up something we talked about a lot. I forget which article it was about this, because this is a pretty big league story. Not just the Indianapolis writers, but a lot of people around the league are looking at this. Hey, and they looked at the same research.
And who said the Titans should draft Anthony Richardson? Who said that? Y'all don't remember this?
Jared Stubman.
There we go. That was Jared's guy. Anthony Richardson's was Jared's guy.
He did explain the other day about how he would have approached this situation if he were Colts general manager.
I see. But the research that we talked about in the you take the young struggling quarterback off the ride, slow it down, sit and watch, learn in the background, and then when the time is right, we'll get you back in there. This is the test of that theory. It has happened a surprisingly few amount of times. We did the research, right? Because I was curious, because I floated that out there, that maybe that's what this situation called for Will Levis. And they haven't really gone that route. Were it not for the injury, they may never have gone that route. But it sounds like in Indianapolis, they're willing to do this not just for this week, but for the foreseeable, right?
They had to have convinced the owner, because obviously I think this was a owner's choice in regards to drafting Richardson.
Make his voice heard.
They had to convince the owner that, hey, listen, we still have a shot at winning the division. And we know the owner wants to win the division no matter what. We still have a shot at winning the division. But it's going to cause for us to bench the quarterback that you love. It's got to be a trade-off here. It's got to be you get what you want on both ends. You get an opportunity to truly compete for the AFC South, all while allowing your young quarterback to learn while not playing, just to watch.
Okay, and it also brings another philosophical discussion that we have hashed out a bunch on this show. And it stands to reason right now, because you've got a 1-6 team where there is a lot of doubt and a lot of heat right now on the general manager and the young head coach. And it goes something like this, right? We know how the song goes. You told us you would be competitive. You said you would be competitive. Well, this is what the Colts are, but the counter argument in Indianapolis right now, and there's a passionate article in The Athletic I could refer you to, is what are they doing? Who cares if they go 9-8 or 10-7 and get whipped by what appears to be a pretty decent gap of the top of the AFC, Baltimore, Kansas City, etc. That's the other side of the coin. So there are people yelling, stick with Richardson and let him go through it regardless of what the record is. Who cares? It's not worth trying to sneak into the playoffs. I see both sides of the argument, but it's interesting that because the Titans have flopped and not done well, they could have been in this dilemma, right? But now they've got a completely separate dilemma.
615-737-1025. We'll wrap up this conversation and our show next. Louis Donick, Derek Mason, and Adam Vignon, 1025, 1063, The Game. Teammates Vingan and Donick, 1025, 1063, The Game. Stoneman and Company coming up next right here at 2 o'clock. We will be at Bridgestone Arena tomorrow for Halloween. Predators Oilers tomorrow night at Bridgestone Arena. Someone who will not be there, Connor McDavid. Connor McDavid out with an ankle injury. So no Connor McDavid for the Oilers tomorrow when they visit the Predators. We'll see if the Predators can continue their point streak. They have points in four consecutive games, 3-0-1 since starting the season, 0-5-0. So to wrap up our conversation today on the Anthony Richardson, Will Levis young quarterback front, I saw this from Joel Erickson, who reports on the Colts for the Indianapolis Star. And writing about the Colts' decision to bench Anthony Richardson, he did an informal study, he called it. Mm-hmm. Out of the 74 quarterbacks drafted in the first round since 2000, only two were drafted, inserted into the starting lineup, benched, and then restored to the starting lineup. Alex Smith with the 49ers and Rex Grossman with the Bears. Mm-hmm. So an informal study, two out of 74 first-round quarterbacks since 2000 that were drafted, inserted into the lineup, bench, then restored to the starting lineup. And we tried to do this exercise a few weeks ago, and we couldn't really come up with it.
I remember looking at the Alex Smith. Mm-hmm. It, if I remember correctly, it was fairly brief. There was Tim Rattay in there. It was a mess of a team. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't out for long. But I am curious because you were the one that said it early, D-Mace. It's harder to go back than you think. And so when will that day come for Anthony Richardson? When you're that high of a pick, Flacco's going to have to play super well. I will say in 2008, remember when Vince Young kind of had the meltdown early in the season and they went to Kerry Collins and then they went 10-0.
Yeah.
And they didn't go back. They eventually did go back to Vince Young in the years after that because they started 0-6 the next year. That was a really interesting roller coaster ride for Vince Young. But I wonder what they will do and when the right time that they could go back to Richardson.
See,
like, if they're, is it safe to say if they're in contention,
they're not going back.
They're not going back to Richardson while that is.
Unless that happens to Joe. But I see this from this standpoint. I think Indianapolis is in a sort of a good position because I know we had some texters say, well, you know, what's the difference between, you know, Indianapolis, you know, barely skating into the playoffs or, you know, just playing it out with Anthony Richardson or here in Nashville. But I think the difference with Indy is Indy believes that they have their quarterback for the future. Now, does he need to get better? Yes. So draft position isn't necessary for them, meaning we're not looking for our next quarterback, so we don't have to get in the top five. We just need more key players to add to it. So if we're picking anywhere from 11 to 15, that's still good for us, all while letting our fan base know, look at what we did. You know, we made it to the playoffs. We added more weapons for our young quarterback. Now we're going to insert him. So, in theory, our team got better while our young quarterback sat. Now we get to put him in a more advantageous situation, both offensively and defensively, because I guarantee you, the Indianapolis Colts this offseason will look to bolster their defense because they know that once they put Richardson underneath center, they got to have something to offset his potential bad play. And what offsets a quarterback's potential bad play is a really good defense, a defense that can hold a team under 14 points majority of the times. So he still gives us – they give us an opportunity to win with the young quarterback.
Completion percentage is a far from perfect statistic, but this according to ESPN. So Anthony Richardson has a 44.4% completion percentage this season. This century, only Akili Smith in 2000 was worse.
Ooh.
He completed 44.2% and would start only three more games after that season before falling out of the league. So poor completion percentages since 2000.
Yeah, Akili Smith would be in the Ryan Leaf.
Yes.
Immediately didn't go well and never did.
Ryan Leaf, Jamarcus Russell.
Well, speaking of Jamarcus Russell, so these are the five worst completion percentages since 2000. Akili Smith in 2000, 44.2. Anthony Richardson this season, 44.4. Tim Tebow in 2011, 46.5. Jamarcus Russell in 2009, 48.8. J.P. Lossman in 2005, 49.6.
That's bad.
That is bad.
Is there nuance to that? That could be.
Of the 816 quarterbacking seasons since 2000, Richardson's 12.3 air yards per target is the highest mark. Nobody is throwing downfield more than Richardson right now. And his company since 2000 is at least a little bit promising.
And that doesn't help.
No. But the company he keeps in that. 2011 Tebow, 2006 Michael Vick, 2019 Matthew Stafford, 2018 Jameis Winston, 2006 Tony Romo, 2018 Josh Allen, and 2015 Carson Palmer.
You don't help your young quarterback when you're looking, regardless of how strong his arm is, and I think sometimes offensive coordinators get too enamored with the strength of a quarterback's arm. You throwing it downfield only hurts the young quarterback because there are going to be more long fly balls or knockdown passes than there are completions. And all of that goes to his, you know, completion percentage at the end. Try to work the quick screen. Try to work the intermediate stuff. Allow him to sort of feel his way through that and then start to go downfield. Because what you're doing is you're setting this kid up for failure. That's what you're doing, because you're looking at the sort of attribute that he possesses, the strong arm. You're not looking at how do I develop this quarterback. You know, I need to develop him from line of scrimmage to 10 yards down the field. How can we develop him and make him the best quarterback within that realm? Once we do that, now we can throw it downfield. Because if you don't get that right, from the line of scrimmage to the 10 or 15 yards, how do you expect to get the long ball right?
It's a good question. And apparently, according to Twitter, Josh Downs found out about the decision on social media.
See, and then you don't tell your players. That's another thing. Like, you make these decisions, which you can make them because you are running the team, but then you don't notify everybody else that's going to be affected by it, good or bad. You don't notify them until X does it, or Twitter, whatever you want to call it nowadays.
Never a good sign when you find out about something first on Twitter that you should probably know before it's on Twitter.
Yeah.
But such is the state of the Indianapolis Colts. We'll continue our Titans conversation tomorrow as we look forward, if you want to call it looking forward, to Titans-Patriots on Sunday. Elliot Freeman will join us to talk hockey at 1 o'clock. Silly Underdog Picks at noon. We will be live from Bridgestone Arena, where the Predators host the Edmonton Oilers. Stillman and Company coming up next, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.
Be love, loving your people. Have a wonderful and blessed Wednesday. Peace.
Yeah.
It's only 155. Yeah, we're
not rubbing on
Rand
Carthon.
We barely talked about that.
Exactly. We didn't even get into Rand Carthon. That was a one-day conversation. I could have brought it up for 2 days.
That's not a one-day conversation.
That's a one-day conversation. Because I went back and I wanted to read that whole article.